This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. College campuses across the nation are responding to what's being revealed as an epidemic of sexual assaults. A study by the Association of American Universities found that 23% of female college students experience some form of sexual assault. But who knows the real number? The Department of Justice estimates that only 20% of sexual assaults are reported. The problem of sexual assault gets even more staggering the more you dig. The Baylor University football team had 52 accusations of rape against 31 players from 2011 to 2014. The allegations are laid out in a 146-page lawsuit filed earlier this year, including claims that the team's coaching staff used women at the school as recruiting tools for high school athletes. And so to have this epidemic of sexual assault on the football team or across the campus, it must have gone beyond just the players. It seems like there is a willful ignorance on the part of university staff all the way to the very top. And what I mean by the very top, I mean society. Is this a culture of rape in America, and including especially in with American college athletes, our athletic programs? Call in. We want to talk about that this afternoon. What's the deal between, what's the connection between rape culture and college athletics? 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined this hour by Jessica Luther. She's the author of the book Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape. Dan Solomon is with us, a writer for Texas Monthly. He co-wrote with Jessica the article, the 2015 article, Silence at Baylor University, at Texas Monthly. And also with us is Diana Moskovich. She is a senior editor for sports, the sports website Deadspin. Welcome to The Source, all of y'all. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Jessica Luther, it's great to talk to you again. Tell me, give us a refresher on the Baylor sexual assault scandal. What exactly are we talking about when we say that?
Yeah, it's a very extensive, I mean, it's hard to sort of say it in a few words. Dan and I wrote a piece in August of 2015 about one player, Sam Muguachu, who was on trial for sexual assault. He was convicted. That conviction has recently been overturned on appeal. There's sort of a lot going on with his case. But he was the second Baylor player to be convicted of sexual assault within a two-year period. No one had reported on Muguachu until August of that year. First the Trib, then Diana, actually, and then us. And it became a national story. Baylor then hired an outside law firm, Pepper Hamilton, to do an investigation of how the school was handling sexual assault reports across the board at the university. When those results of that investigation came back, I want to say in April of last year, April, May, they ended up firing the head coach of the football team, Art Briles. They put on suspension or probation the athletic director, Ian McCall, and they demoted the president of the university, Ken Starr. All three are actually gone now. But it's continued to unfold. So there is another player, former player Sean Oakman, who has been arrested and is facing trial for sexual assault. And then we've had multiple lawsuits. I actually don't even know how many there are at this point. There's so many women that are actually suing the school, maybe 10, 12, something like that. So, yeah, and like you said, you know, some of the numbers are as high as 52 rapes by 31 different players over a certain amount of time. The school, I think, has officially said that there were 19 reports of violence against women by 17 players in like a 5 or 6 year period of time. So it's been very extensive, and it goes all the way to the top. And I want to say that the Pepper Hamilton report found that there were issues within the athletic department, the football team in particular, but the university at large. So the school itself has had an issue with how they handle these reports. It's just the lens, the microcosm of the football team sort of brings all that out. We can see sort of how extensive the issue is.
Dan Solomon, when did you start to get an inkling that this was going to be a really big story?
Well, we didn't really understand the scope of what we were looking at while we were reporting on Sam Muguachu. We knew that there was going to be that was a significant story on its own, But, you know, I don't think we predicted that this was going to be, you know, this was going to involve so many players over such a long period of time. It was strange because it's really unusual to see one player convicted of sexual assault in a college town. To see two in 2 years was definitely striking. And so, you know, we believed that there was something unusual going on with the Ukawachi case because it was really hard to find information on it. And that's not what you would expect with a, you know, a football player on a leading in a leading program to be, you know, facing trial for sexual assault, not just arrest, not just accusations, but actually about to stand trial. There was still almost nothing there. So we had the only inkling we had was that there was a lot we didn't know.
So so that means that the local media that usually covers the college sports program, like this incredible, like anything that moves, they got it on, that they ignored the story. Is that what you're saying?
You know, I don't know if they ignored it or if they didn't look very hard for it. It's surprising because if you're a sports reporter in Waco, you are going to be pretty well connected to what's going on the Baylor football team, especially in, you know, 2015. So it's surprising. And there were ways, you know, we found on Baylor fan message boards on the internet, we found people talking about these accusations against Ukawachi, people who, you know, just kind of anonymous voices on these message boards saying, oh, well, you know, if you remember Tevin Elliott, who was the player who was convicted a year before, then you're going to be reminded of that when you see Sam Ukawachu. And so there were definitely clues out there if someone were curious about why Ukawachu had been, you know, suspended from the team. There were clues out there as to what was really going on, but those hadn't been followed up on and printed anyway.
Well, speaking of clues, there may have been clues that Ukawachu could have been a troubled individual to the way that he left Boise State in 2013. Can you talk about that, Dan Solomon?
Yeah. So we knew that there was some pretty detailed information in that came out in the discovery process of the trial. And so there were some communications internally from Boise State that indicated that that the athletic director, the assistant athletic director there, was aware that there had been some violent incidents with Ukawachu and his then girlfriend, and that he had been he had put his fist through a window while in an argument with her, and that his coaches and his athletic staff were afraid for her safety and for his roommate's safety and for people around him, and the communication between Boise State and Baylor left a lot to be desired and sort of how we, and it's, you know, there aren't emails in there saying this guy's dangerous there, but they didn't ask very many questions in those emails either. So we know that after Ukawachi was convicted, that the then coach of Boise State said that Briles was apprised of everything. And it ended up being the sort of back and forth he said, she said about what they knew. But we do know that there were definitely things that a person who wanted to know if Sam Ukawachu presented a danger to other students on campus should have known.
Yeah, so this sets the narrative that there is a win-at-any-cost attitude at Baylor. They were willing to pick up someone who could be considered damaged goods, who left another team. He was a talented player. They wanted him at Baylor, and so they didn't really ask a lot of questions, or they didn't really factor that information into their final decision. We're going to continue the conversation as we talk about rape culture in college athletics. This is The Source. The number to call in if you got a question or comment is 210-614-8980. 8980. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. How does the current system propagate rape culture in college athletic departments across the nation? What can we do to protect students? Should we be teaching our athletes not to rape? Joining us to talk about that, we've got Jessica Luther. She's the author of the book Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape. Dan Solomon, a writer for Texas Monthly, who co-wrote the 2015 Silence at Baylor article with Jessica Luther. Also with us is Diana Moskovich. She is a senior editor for sports website Deadspin. And Diana, so you have a different, you have a more of a national view about this, and does this Baylor University scandal, does this really jump out as unusual?
It jumps out in terms of the attention it's gotten, and in terms of the numbers, since Pepper Hamilton's report, they've gotten even worse. There was a lawsuit that alleged that there were 52 acts of rape, including 5 gang rapes by about 31 football players. So it's the numbers have gotten even bigger since then. But in terms of just the idea of a football program and a university where sexual assault is not taken very seriously is perhaps the most polite way to put it. That's a story that I've written in about, and other people here at Deadspin have written at universities across the country in different conferences. It even involves the Ivy Leagues. Yale, just a couple of seasons ago, lost a basketball player after a Title IX investigation involving sexual assault. So this is to varying degrees all over college campuses and all over athletics.
Baylor University just announced that they were hiring Linda Livingston to be the new president of the university. This is the first time that a woman has been hired to become the president of this school. Does that in and of itself mean anything to you, Diana, as trying to fix a problem?
Not really. It's a fresh set of eyes. It's a new person. And I hope that she does a lot of work to change the culture at Baylor. But just the fact that she's a woman and not Ken Starr doesn't mean much to me. We have to see what she does. And I hope she steps up to the challenge, but only she knows ultimately if she's going to do that.
Jessica Luther, in the press release from Baylor University announcing the hiring of Linda Livingston, they mentioned they have the word Christian 11 times in their press release. They don't have the word rape or sexual assault once. Does that mean anything?
Oh, I just think it's indicative of the culture at Baylor. I mean, it's a big deal. It's the biggest Baptist university in the world, I believe. And that is, you know, a very important part of the story. It has a lot to do with who chooses to go there and the general population of students and the, you know, the way that they market themselves out into the world. Their Christianity plays a very big role. I'm not surprised that they didn't address sexual assault directly in that press release. They tend to talk around it pretty well over there.
Dan Solomon, because of that Christianity code of conduct that they have, there's a ban on drinking at Baylor University among the students. And frequently that's been used to turn itself against the victims of the sexual assaults. They ask the first question they ask them is, were you drinking? And now they're in trouble. Is that what happened?
Well, you know, we've heard from people that that is how things would start. They instituted a policy that basically you're not going to get in trouble for drinking when you're reporting that, which if that's something that students feel secure in, that's definitely a good thing. There was certainly a time, as we've been told and we kind of understand it, that if you went to report a Title IX claim or to report sexual assault, you know, one of the things they would say is that, well, you know, we are going to have to tell your parents that you were drinking. Are you sure you want to go through with this? And obviously that is really troubling.
Right. But these changes about saying now that if you want to report a sexual assault and you were drinking, we won't hold that against you. That came as a result of the reveal of the scandal, right?
As I understand it, yeah.
Okay. So prior to that, that was something that they used to try to silence potential victims, Jessica?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just like Dan described, I mean, they would, you know, what people have told reporters is that, yeah, they would basically say, we're going to tell your parents that you've been doing this thing that you're not supposed to. And then you could possibly get in trouble with the school because that is breaking the rule. But they did put in this amnesty policy under the former Title IX coordinator that if you report and you have been breaking some other rule in the student conduct code at the time that you were victimized, that they would not hold, that you couldn't get in trouble for that thing when you can't get in trouble for that thing when you go to report that you've been victimized.
Okay, our phone lines, we got some callers here. We got some room for more if you want to call in 210-614-8980. Joshua is on the line. And Joshua, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I lived in both Philadelphia and out in the sticks in Tennessee near the University of the South. And I noticed in both instances that the police had a lot of discretion. And I wondered how much the private police force that the university has, how much that plays into reporting incidents, and especially incidents against women, violence against women. Let me get off the air so you can comment.
All right, thanks for the call, Joshua. So, Jessica Luther, there's two police forces, I think, that need to be talked about. One of them is the campus police, and then there's the city police from Waco. Were they sort of in cahoots here?
You know, this is one of the things that's hard to trace out in the public record of, you know, what if there is collusion and what's sort of going on here. What we do know for sure is that across the board, across the country, people don't report to the police. There was just a huge study at the University of Texas at Austin that found that of all the people that said that they have been, all the students that have been victimized while a student at the University of Texas, 2% went to the police. So that's certainly an issue. And then, yeah, at these private universities, they have campus police, and it's very hard to get any sort of, you know, there's no sunshine on what's going on with these police forces because they sort of get to hide behind the fact that they're private. There is a law now that says that police forces in Texas, that private campus police forces have to release their records. Baylor PD in particular have not really been doing that under the law. So, yeah, I do think that plays a role. And I think these students are aware that, you know, reporting to the cops might not lend any justice in the end.
And Diana Moskowitz over at Deadspin, is that a national trend where when you have a major university in a college town, they basically can call the shots with the local PD?
It's an issue across the country. I'd say that the dynamics change a little bit based on the university and the city. So here in Los Angeles, there's an issue where women will report to the LAPD, and the LAPD is just so big that what happened to this one person, even though it was a horrible traumatic sexual assault, it's not a priority to them. The flip side is when you have a small college town and a big university, you know, like I'll use my alma mater as an example, the University of Florida, yeah, there's going to be concerns about collusion, about undue influence with the city police, and especially with campus police, where it can be essentially a closed ecosystem if it happened on campus. And there are campus police chiefs who answer to the university president. That seems like it could be a conflict of interest for certain. It's an issue everywhere. Like I said, the dynamics might change based on the city, based on the university, but it's an all too common thing you'll hear where women just say, I'm not comfortable going to the police with this.
Okay.
And that's a huge issue.
Now, Bonnie has a similar comment to make. Bonnie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was wondering about local law enforcement, not just in this case, but in any case. These are felonies. Universities don't have the authority to jail offenders.
Right. Okay.
And I'm not sure why we don't just treat this as felonies and report it as such. It's not sports news. It's felony.
Got it. Bonnie, thank you for the call. So, Dan Solomon, what about that? Why does a university able to decide that that they're going to handle this case from beginning to end, or they can't?
Well, so it depends on what the person who the victim wants to do. If the victim wants to go to police and pursue this as a criminal case, they can do that. The way that the university system works is that they have rights that aren't just within the criminal system. So under Title IX, they have to have the full access to education. And if they're in a class with someone who raped them, then they probably aren't being given that full access. So the Title IX process is intended to give them a way to maintain their access to education so that they can go to they can go to class without being in class with a rapist. So that's why the university is involved in this. It's not kind of an alternate justice system. It's just a way for the victim to have accommodations made under federal law. So if it is a felony, the victim has the right to go to police. And it doesn't always work. You know, there are plenty of cases where someone went to police to report being raped and the police didn't treat them as though they were the victim of a crime. You know, so I understand why victims don't do it. And that's also kind of another reason why the Title IX process exists, because sometimes going to the police isn't going to get you the justice that you seek. And so there's, at least this way, they have some way to get through a university program. There's also an issue where the wheels of justice move slowly. College is a four-year process, and not everybody in college who is the victim of a sexual assault is, you know, going to be at the start of their college career. So sometimes you'll want a way that can deal with this more quickly than the criminal justice system can. You can do both, but this gives an extra option.
Okay, caller with Robert. And hi, Robert. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I missed some of the show, so I hope I'm not repeating a question you've answered. But at the beginning, I heard 25% of women suffer some sort of sexual assault in their college career. And then later I heard that only 2% are reported. So I'm confused by the numbers, and I'm just curious. Okay. If there's a study that shows the population in general and the athletics separated, just for comparison purposes, and I'll hang up to try to hear.
All right, Robert, thanks for the call. So, Jessica Luther, what are the numbers?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think this is one of the most difficult things about talking about this issue is that it's massively underreported. Like, something that we can say for sure, 100%, is that almost all, like, the majority of these cases never get reported into any kind of system, be that a civil one or a criminal one. So it's really hard to sort of pin down statistics. And it's, you know, we don't know. There are some studies that suggest that athletes perpetrate more violence than the general population. I think we have to be careful about those kind of studies, again, because of underreporting, but also just it's really easy to say that group does it, this other group doesn't, and then we sort of take away the focus on the overall problem. And there's been work done on professional athletes. The site 538 showed that they aren't arrested or charged more for domestic violence than the general population. But yeah, as far as, you know, the 1 in 4, 1 in 5 women will experience sexual assault while at university versus, you know, the 2% who might report it to the police, this is, you know, born out of experience. When you talk to victims of this kind of violence, they face retaliation, they face intimidation, they often are, you know, their veracity is questioned, like are they lying? They become the suspect in a lot of ways. When they go to report, they're blamed in a lot of ways. They know this before they get there. They live in this culture where we blame victims all the time, like they expect it to happen. So they're worried about reporting and what's going to happen to them. You hear from victims that they want their parents to know.
Right,
like they don't want their parents to look at them differently, right? So there's a lot of reasons not to report. And this is one of the things that we have to figure out and do better.
Okay, we're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break. We want to dig in more into the book, Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape, about what can be done, what steps can be taken on college campuses to protect our students. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We're talking about rape culture on college athletics, on college campuses. What steps can be done to disrupt this sort of a twisted version of masculinity, allowing for a rape? Do we do that? Is that happening in society, that we allow for this? We just accept that this is going to be part of the experience and have acceptable numbers for women who are sexually assaulted on our college campuses. Number is 210-614-8980. Jessica Luther is with us. She's the author of the book Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape. And so, but Jessica, people you know, we talked about Baylor quite a bit, but this book is really not about Baylor. This is really about behavior and about why this happens frequently on college campuses and what we can do, or some plays that you have for to try and disrupt that behavior. Is that right?
Yeah, I wrote a book. I mean, I actually wrote the book before we reported on Baylor. Baylor's the epilogue in the book. So it's very much about the system of college football in general and what allows people to continually turn away from this issue. You know, and I talk about it in college football because I think that's just where we end up talking about it a lot. So I think it's a really useful lens into this. But yeah, part of it is, you know, simply acknowledging that this isn't actually an issue. You know, I think there's a lot of campuses that are sort of begrudgingly pulled along to have to admit that, like, this is something they need to take on. And then beyond that, you know, we need better accountability. We're seeing that over the last year. We had two major football coaches or coaches at major programs fired around sexual assault, how they handled it. One was Art Briles at Baylor, but one was Clay's at Minnesota. He was fired at the end of last year after a whole big, you know, problem with an alleged gang rape at the University of Minnesota with multiple players there. So we need accountability at the top. But instead of, you know, one thing I often talk about is instead of always the reaction once harm has been done and reported is that we need to start thinking about prevention and sort of what do we need to do to change the culture. I'd love to talk about consent and consent education anytime that I get a chance. I think it's a big cultural failure on our part, the way that we talk about consent and how rarely we talk about it and how we define it. And yeah, and so I think a big thing under Title IX, under federal law, schools now have to do preventative education around this. It's often, you know, a one-hour course, a video that you watch on the computer when you first get to campus as a freshman, and that's sort of the end of it. It needs to be comprehensive. It needs to be taught by people who know what they're talking about, and it has to extend, not just then, but, you know, across the 4 years. And, you know, if I ruled the world, we'd be teaching it from kindergarten on, but I don't. So at this point, what we have under federal law is that universities have to do this. And so they really do need to step up their preventative education.
210-614-8980. If you want to join our conversation like Christian did. And Christian, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I remember in high school, witnessing cheerleaders dancing in a way that was sexually suggestive, and I remember seeing the students react strongly towards that, liking that a lot. And I went to an all-boys Catholic high school. So is it possible that the reason why college athletes are maybe engaging in crimes like rape is because they were maybe encouraged to do so when they were in high school?
Diana Moskowitz from Deadspin, your take on that?
Oh, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, first, I think it's important to divorce this idea of, you know, dancing in a suggestive way, therefore rape happens. I think it's fair to say that we should be raising boys and men who can see that. And yes, perhaps be turned on, but when the woman says, okay, no, you know, now I'd like this to stop, that he respects that, no. And that's the end of that. So first, I'd like to address that. But more broadly, in terms of high school, yeah, you can certainly say the players don't just show up at college. No student just shows up at college and is suddenly coming up with these, you know, ideas that they deserved sex, that when a woman says no, she really just means you need to be pushing me harder. And it goes back to what Jessica said about consent education. This is something we should be talking about in high school, in middle school, you know, maybe even in elementary school. There are plenty of Title IX suits brought in high school cases. It applies to them as well, with hazing, with sexual assault,
This is not an issue that just suddenly happens on college campuses out of nowhere. It goes way, way back, deep into our education system, deep into our society, and you know, that's why I agree with Jessica about the importance of talking about consent and talking about it early and not waiting until people are 18 to suddenly have these conversations with them and expect them to just go along with it and be okay when for 18 years we've given them the completely opposite message as a society about what to do.
So that brings up the case that's happening near here in San Antonio at Lavernia High School, where 13 student-athletes, male student-athletes, have been arrested, accused of participating in hazing, initiation, sodomizing of fellow varsity players, sodomizing with objects. And so that's become a scandal in that small town just outside of San Antonio. And it's the details are graphic and they're stunning, and how widespread and how long this went on before the story broke is incredible. Jessica Luther, so as you talk about, you know, college football and the politics of rape, you know, you got to think about, you know, college preparatory school, you know, as we prepare kids for college. You know, the one expert I talked to in hazing said kids are turning up in college better prepared for this type of behavior than they are for writing a term paper.
Oh, gosh, what even? I mean, that's so upsetting. And, you know, part of it is, yeah, I mean, I wrote a book on college football and I did that because that's where the conversation is. We don't have a conversation about this with younger students. It's something like 10% of all girls in high school report that they've been sexually assaulted, right? We get this line. I'm sure Dan has heard this a lot too. I would never send my daughter to Baylor after all the stuff that I've heard. And my response to that is like, did you send your daughter to high school? This isn't over. I mean, this is a huge problem, and it absolutely starts younger. And, you know, this case in San Antonio, outside of San Antonio, is on the heels of other big cases in high school programs. I think there were a couple in the last 2 or 3 years that have been, they've shut down the entire program because of the cases of sodomy and rape that were reported as, you know, quote unquote hazing. There was just a AP, the Associated Press, just ran a piece 2 days ago about the extent of quote-unquote hazing in high school athletics and how it's painted over and people turn away. Coaches know, they don't care. Everything is minimized by the language that we use, including calling it bullying or hazing, the sort of normalizing of it as normal social behavior that you just have to put up with if you're going to do this sport in this space, when in fact it's actually a crime and it's a violation, and it's horrific.
Dan Solomon, is part of the issue when we try to come up with numbers or encourage, try and figure out what happened, is that we're not really clear on what it is that we mean by sexual assault or rape, because frequently people have the idea of some woman being snatched off the jogging path by a complete stranger, and yet that's not actually what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge part of the problem, right? I mean, it's a part of why the numbers for who reports are so low, because, you know, women who know that they've been raped don't have a story that they can tell that they believe is going to convince a police officer or a jury, or, you know, sometimes even their friends and family. So, you know, the idea that we only talk about rape in the sense that it's, you know, someone who screamed no and was, you know, unable to get out of the situation. You know, that's a dangerous part of how we talk about this, because it really does discourage people who are victims of sexual assault from saying so. And it makes sense why they wouldn't want to say so, because we don't take it seriously unless we have a context for it that that fits a pretty clear narrative. And a lot of these cases don't. So, yeah, I think that that's a huge problem.
And so education, and generally, and particularly towards young women, Jessica, is that important? They know what their rights are and they know where the boundaries are supposed to be?
Yeah, I think everyone needs education. I think that this is one of the things as we, I mean, one of the issues is that we only talk about consent when it comes to sex. And at this one particular moment in time, consent's a much bigger issue. We all have them within all of our relationships. We can talk about boundaries in lots of ways. Do you respect other people's boundaries when they tell you yes or no in lots of different circumstances? And, you know, girls as well as boys need to understand what a healthy relationship actually looks like.
So what do you mean by other circumstances? Other than sex, what do you mean?
Like, yeah, I think we all have that. I mean, I always joke about, like, your parents. Do you tell your parents, like, hey, I really can't talk tomorrow. Please don't call me. I'll be really busy. And they call you anyway. And then they get upset because you didn't talk to them on the phone, right? Like, when you set an expectation and you draw a boundary and then the person that you are in that relationship with just doesn't listen to you, right? Or you do that too, right? Like, how do we respect? How do we talk about boundaries? Do we respect them?
So eliminating mixed messages consent, out of eliminating mixed messages from our life entirely.
Absolutely. I mean, communication, we need to be better about it. We need to be more open about how we should be doing it and what that's healthy. And that's what we need to be. That's the goal.
All right. We're going to keep talking about this. We got another segment. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. We're going to talk about some of the plays that Jessica Luther says needs to happen in order to teach young men about what no actually means and respecting boundaries and getting proper consent. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about sexual assault, rape culture in college athletics, and what steps should be taken to disrupt this pattern that we have here, this enabling society that allows this to happen. The number is 210-614-8980 if you've got a question or a comment. We got an email from Christopher. And in the email, he sent a link to a book called The Campus Rape Frenzy about the myth of the rape culture and college on college campuses and how this myth has had a detrimental impact on due process rights. He says that there are women who make false accusations in order to gain status and to benefit from this system. So let me ask you, Diana Moskowitz, is that a consideration?
Ah, that comes up all the time with this issue. And I always say that first to understand my answer, you need to understand before I was a sports reporter, I was a crime reporter. And if you look at every crime handled by our criminal justice system, there is a percentage that we get wrong. The highest percentage that we can say for certain is actually with murder cases. We tend to have to go back and say we wrongly convicted a person on those a lot. We have had to yank people off of death row thanks to the work of the Innocence Project. And yet, this concern for wrongly convicting people only comes up to me when I'm talking about rape, sexual assault, and domestic violence. I think it's important to point out that we only worry about fairness when we're talking about crimes that disproportionately affect women and especially other members of the community, like the LGBT community, groups that in some ways still feel marginalized. And we need to have a fair process for everybody. We need due process for everybody. Those are legitimate concerns, but for some reason they only come up when we talk about violence against women. Even though you can look at lots of stats and say we should be completely revamping how we adjudicate murder in this country, a country that will send you away to prison for even longer, a crime that will put you potentially on death row. And so, nobody ever emails me asking why there isn't better due process in murder cases.
Jessica Luther, what's the upside for a woman to make a false accusation of sexual assault when you're a student at Baylor University?
I don't know if there's any kind of upside to this. I mean,
would they profit from it? Would they get a big paycheck out of it? Or I mean, from what I understand, a lot of these women have been harassed online and in person.
Yeah, and a lot of them leave school. Like, a lot of them actually don't get to stay. They don't get to finish. They don't get their degree at the school that they wanted to go to. You know, it's not uncommon to hear about victims who have PTSD that deal with, you know, severe mental health issues, which then often have physical issues as well that come out of all of that. They have, you know, they have trouble concentrating. They have trouble just living their daily lives. They have trouble interacting with other men in their lives. You know, they can't hug their dad anymore because of the trauma that they've experienced. Yeah, so maybe they sue. Maybe they get a civil, you know, they win the civil case and they get some money out of it. That's possible. That's not a predetermined outcome in any way. So that's certainly not, if that is your reason for a false accusation, then you have a long road to go. I mean, there's no guarantee there. And the negatives for reporting are so high, we can count them forever. We could be here for another hour talking about what it's like to report. I mean, it's not uncommon for a victim to quote unquote win. Get what justice is available to them, and they will still be sad that they reported it all because of the hell that they went through in the reporting process.
So if someone wanted to cook up a false accusation in order to get a big payday out of it, there are simpler ways of doing that than trying to accuse a college football player on campus of sexual assault. That wouldn't be your first choice.
No, it would not.
Okay. Dan Solomon, this thing about using co-eds, I don't know if we even use that word anymore, on college campus by the football team in order to do recruiting. Baylor had a particular, like a club or something to do that. What were they called? Like Baylor Honeys or something?
The Baylor Bruins.
The Baylor what?
Bruins.
Bruins. And how were they used?
Well, it's not totally clear. There are lawsuits that have been filed that say that, they were used to entice recruits to come to Baylor by, when you have a pretty girl who's there with a teenage boy trying to entice him, she's going to, her job is to act like she's sweet on him no matter what. We don't know exactly what it entailed. We know what the lawsuit alleges, that they were, basically asked to perform sexual favors. We don't know if that's true. We haven't, we've talked to people and we haven't heard that firsthand from people who've been involved. But what we do know is that there's a culture, not just at Baylor, but generally, and this speaks to one of the questions that one of the callers had earlier, which is that, there is certainly a culture that treats women as prizes for boys and men who do good things on the football field or in other aspects of life. And, this definitely plays into that, where the female students at Baylor are seen, and not just at Baylor, but anywhere, are often seen as prizes for the men and the boys who play football well or who, achieve in other aspects of campus life.
So there was this transactional nature of sexual favors for people who decide to play for the football team, and then they would tend to expect that this was part of the benefits package.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the transactional nature was spelled out. I don't know who offered the transaction, but it's implicit. I think that, you understand intuitively that if you're, the big man on campus, then you're going to get girls. And there's an expectation that that's right and that's just and that's something that you deserve. And that really is the issue, that, that these guys feel entitled, and a lot of men do, to the idea that they should, that that they deserve women and that women should be the reward for doing something well.
Okay, Mark has called in. And hi, Mark, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, thanks for taking my call. So one of the things that I wanted to mention was that I traveled last year as a national attorney consultant. And part of what I think the problem is when you have these school-sanctioned organizations participating in such behaviors, it allows student organizations to have a lower bar set. So essentially we're holding student-run organizations to a higher regard in some ways than those that have a distinct hierarchy within the university. I was just wondering if I could comment on that.
Okay, Mark, thank you for the question. And do you want to comment on that, Diana?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure that I completely understand the question. It had to do with the different hierarchies within a university, I think.
We're holding to different standards. Maybe fraternities are being held to a different standard than other organizations, sporting teams.
Yeah, that's...
it's such a difficult thing to really analyze, especially within universities and within education in general, because of a law called FERPA, and it makes all student records not public record, takes them off the table. The creator of this has said many times universities are abusing it. They are not using it as he intended, because basically they use it to withhold just about everything they want to. In some cases, the interpretation is that a document with a student's name on it is therefore a student record. So this just takes a lot of information off the table about what is going on regarding these issues in our schools and our universities. And that's what makes it so hard to still really know, in some ways, what's going on. You know, are these cases being adjudicated fairly? Are different groups of students being treated differently? Certainly there's concerns about if there's racial bias in what's happening. And unfortunately, right now with the interpretation of the law, there's not a lot we can say definitively, so you go by anecdotal evidence, which is far, far from ideal, especially on an issue like this.
Okay.
So right now it's just everyone has their narrative, and the universities are providing very, very little in terms of concrete numbers and analysis so that we can actually see what's going on.
Jessica Luther, your book, you have these ideas, these plays that should be part of teaching student athletes not to be a rapist. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, well, you could just say it to them. I mean, this is part of the problem, is that we bring these students in, and you know, one thing that we hear a lot is, like, the first time some of these people really have an adult talk to them about sex is this, they, you know, they're saying don't rape. There's no context there, because we're not having a full conversation, again, going back to talking about consent and healthy relationships. And we just, you know, I just want to echo what Diana just said. Like, we just need better transparency across the board, from universities, from athletic departments, from high schools. People should be asking lots and lots of questions and demanding a lot of answers. And really, you know, we need more sunshine on this issue. It's really hard to say what's really going on and where the power lies, and who's benefiting from the system where we are ignoring this rampant issue, right? Yeah, transparency is a huge problem.
And consent is cool. Get some, you have in your book.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think this is the point, right? Is, like, we need a better conversation. We need to encourage consent. We need to encourage the communication around it and make sure that people, you know, yes means yes. Like, your partner should be enthusiastic in whatever it is that you're about to engage in, right? Why are you doing it if the other person's not into it as much as you are? That should be the starting point, rather than say no means no. Like, yes means yes, you should be into it. It's cool, man.
Jessica Luther, author of Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape. Dan Solomon, writer for Texas Monthly, co-wrote the 2015 Silence at Baylor article with Jessica Luther. Diana Moskovitz, she is a senior editor for the sports website Deadspin. This is Texas Public Radio's The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.